Hi, and welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kadenek. I'm with John Purcell. Hello, John.
Hello.
And joining me today is one of my favourite cookbook authors. He's got a new book out called Adam Liao's Asian Cookery School. Adam Liao, thanks for joining us.
G'day.
We wanted to sit down and have a chat because I've said to John, I've said to a few people that whenever I talk to you for more than probably a couple of minutes pleasantries, these gold nuggets of Asian cookery and passion come out. And we wanted to talk to you about it. So I guess the easy question is, do you feel like Australians need to change everything they do with Asian cooking?
Not really change everything that we do. We have, I think, the best Asian food in the world in Australia. And I don't say that in any way sarcastically. You know, we have better Vietnamese food than China, and actually better Vietnamese food than Vietnam in many cases as well. We have better Chinese food than Japan, and in many cases than China as well, because we have great ingredients. We have a strong Asian migrant population that cooks those ingredients very authentically, and we have a real appreciation for it as a general population. We love to eat Asian food, and more we're loving how to cook it.
Now, Andrew's going to be asking a whole lot of questions about the food side of Adam Liao, and I'd like to really find out about the man, Adam Liao. And I use that phrase because I was teased about it earlier, so I'm just going to use it now. Because when I saw you on MasterChef, you came across as someone who was already built for TV. It was very confident, had a great manner on TV. And then I've seen you appear on TV shows, and you just stroll on, and you're casual, and it seems to be no problem at all for you to face this kind of an audience. Where does that come from? Is that part of some other past life that you had before getting onto TV?
Not at all. You know, I mean, I was a lawyer beforehand, so the public speaking aspect of it has not been a problem for me, really. Well, it was in the past, but years of legal work have kind of whipped that out of me. But I think with TV, you can't be in awe of it. I think it's very easy to be in awe of TV because you've got all your movie stars and film stars and things on screens that you look at. But I had no intention of ever being on TV, whether it was MasterChef or Destination Flavor or anything else. But I guess from that perspective, it just didn't intimidate me or scare me at all. So I was happy to be on it. It was just kind of like talking to anyone else, which makes it quite easy. But now, after I've been in it for years, and Destination Flavors now in its fourth series, it's kicking along really well. I think what I really like about it is its ability to tell stories. You know, you can tell stories in books, which I love doing as well. You can tell stories in person, or you can tell them on the screen, and it's all kind of different aspects of the same thing.
Do you see dishes meld? We were talking earlier before about how different countries have influenced other countries' cuisine. Mm. Have you found from travelling, have you seen that if you were to speak to a chef 30 years ago about what cooking is like in Sweden, let's say, or in China, can you see that this global village aspect is influencing cuisine around the world?
Hugely. And I think one of the really interesting things about the globalised population is where we choose to take our inspiration from, I guess. You know, a lot of South America takes a lot of food inspiration from China. Of course, there's been migration there, etc. If you see the new Nordic cuisine at the moment, what's really developing out of Denmark and Sweden and Norway, they're taking a lot of cues from Japan. That refined notion and the simplicity of Japanese cuisine has had a huge influence on the new Nordic cuisine, rather than, you know, it's two countries away from France, and yet the biggest influence in their food at the moment, I would say, is Japanese. And even here in Australia, leaving aside the high-end restaurants, you know, walk into your local pub, there's salt and pepper squid on the menu. Mm. Our food here is hugely influenced by Asia, and I think it's one of our real strengths as in defining Australian cuisine.
Yeah. Your book, John wants to explore Madden Liao, the other man.
I got onto the food then. He crossed into an area where I'm very much a foodie. And one of my favourite restaurants is IKEA. And they have the meatballs from Sweden.
Yeah.
And I've been noticing in these books from Nordic, they actually have the meatballs in there. So it's actually a true story. I had no idea.
It's a true story.
Absolutely. They all have their different versions. But the shotbula, as they say in Swedish. He's definitely a culinary icon of that area.
So with one of the main parts about Adam's about the Asian cooking school is the different tastes, flavors, five tastes. Now, four of them we all grew up with. One in Australian culture, anyway, is a strange one. Umami. Yeah. So I've done a lot of reading about this, but it's new. But when you explain it, it actually makes a lot of sense. But tell people at home what it is.
Well,
umami. I don't know why you had a problem with it, John. It's easy to pronounce.
I have a. It's really the first thing you got to explain when you explain umami is that the five things that we taste are different from the flavors that are in food. There are thousands, millions of different flavors and flavor combinations that you can have in food, but they tend to be tasted with your nose. So the different characteristics of wine that you get are far more aroma based. And what we think about the flavor of food is far more aroma based than it is mouth based. And that's great, but when you think about the taste that you actually taste with your mouth, the taste buds that are on your tongue, there are five that are fundamentally important: salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. And we know what salt, sweet, sour, and bitter are, and they all serve an absolute purpose. Salt makes sure we have salts for our muscles to work. Sugar is there for energy. Sourness and bitterness were historically used, I guess, in evolutionary context to help you avoid poisonous berries, etc. Umami is one that gets almost no attention in Western media anyway. In Asia, it's been sort of a common concept for centuries now. And it's so basic. What it essentially does, it's not as easy to explain as salt. Salty things taste salty because of salt.
Mm.
And sweet things taste sweet because of sugar.
Yeah.
Umami things taste delicious because of umami molecules, you know, and those are molecules that are naturally found, you know, they're artificially found as well. You can add MSG to something that's umami in its purest form, but they're naturally found in reactions where you grill a steak. You know, you grill a steak and it tastes better than if you boiled it, for example. You roast a chicken, it tastes better when it's got that nice golden crispy skin. A lot of things that, reactions that turn food brown are what make it delicious, and it's commonly found in Parmesan cheese and in tomatoes and in kombu seaweed and shiitake mushrooms, all forms of mushrooms, really, particularly when they're dried. And so umami is just fundamental to the way food tastes good. And if you actually look at it at a physiological level, umami, think about stock, you know, you've got chicken stock in France or beef stock or katsu dashi in Japan or pork bone broth in China, whatever you want to call it. And all of those stocks tend to have around the same concentration of these umami molecules in them. So it's this fundamental building block of cooking and eating that we don't tend to pay too much attention to. Actually, that concentration of umami molecules in stock, can you guess where you might find that in nature? Whether it's, you know, any stock, that it has roughly the same concentration as of umami molecules as you find in human breast milk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we are physiologically designed to appreciate good tasting food and umami in food, and that's kind of the basis of...
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'm not going to talk about the bone broth talk that came in. I'm going to leave that, but for people at home, they can probably Google that and work out where we're going.
I've got another... Adam
the Other Man. Dive into Adam the Other Man.
I almost want a separate show.
If this was on television, there'd be a cutaway of you nodding yeah, very seriously.
Yeah,
right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you went into law.
Yes.
You seem like a nice guy. How did you end up in law?
A series of terrible mistakes. I don't know. No, it was. I really enjoyed it. You know, I was a media lawyer for many years, an environmental lawyer before that, and there's something about this problem solving ability in law that relates well to cooking as well. You know, if you want to find your way through a problem or you want to create a particular taste or contract or something, that problem solving is pretty much universal across all disciplines, I'd say.
And in doing law, there's quite a bit of reading, and you must have gotten the habit of doing a lot of reading. Are you consider yourself a big reader now in history or in philosophy or in literature or in cookbooks? What are you a reader?
With all the free time that you have.
Yeah, with all the free time that you have.
I have to be honest, I read less now that I write books than I did before.
Yeah, well, it does take some time.
It's the same for every author.
It's ironic, really, but I do read an awful lot less. I still do, you know, get through 2 or 3 novels a year, I would say. But I'm more focused on non-fiction in my reading these days. I read, you know, whether it's food non-fiction or biographies or historical novels, that kind of thing.
And you still do travel outside of the show?
Yeah, I do.
You were biking in Japan when I spoke to you.
I cycled around Japan. I went polar bear spotting in Svalbard Archipelago in the north of Norway this year. And
it's easier in the desert.
Yeah.
Pick them out.
It's a camouflage.
I do a fair bit of travel, but I've got a young family now, and so that tends to keep me home a bit more. Even last year we had our young son. I had him strapped to my back up a sand dune in the middle of the desert in Abu Dhabi, 4 hours outside of Abu Dhabi, which is possibly bad parenting. Worked out quite well. So yeah, I mean, I still do get around a fair bit.
Does writing? Sorry, if I can just go aside slightly. Yeah. Let's Adam Lau / the cookbook man. When I read now, I. It's difficult for me to read a classic because I feel guilty because I'm not reading a new release, therefore reading for work. Do you feel guilty when you're at home and you're cooking, if you're cooking and thinking, I'm just going to cook a favourite, one of my favourites, that you're not looking forward to the next, a new recipe? Do you feel guilty, like that cooking is work kind of now?
No, I don't feel guilty at all. And in fact, I probably cook more out of my existing cookbooks than anything else. I'm pretty much the laziest cookbook writer ever in that we only my cookbooks tend to be full of all the stuff that we eat at home. And so we'll do the old favourites that are already in the books, but I have a pretty adventurous family and my son and my wife don't mind trying new things. So if I'm coming up with new recipes for a book, I have to come up with an awful lot of recipes. I write a bunch of columns and I write a bunch of books, and I'm probably doing 400-500 recipes a year, so I know that if I come up with a recipe for family dinner one night, then that's one less recipe I'd come up with in a intensive period trying to flesh out some ideas in a book. So I don't feel guilty, but I do try to cook new things, and that's not trying to find new dishes that are unheard of or anything. I tend to try and take in existing recipes or existing things that I've cooked and then try and simplify them, because in my view, the more you can simplify food, the better it is in terms of taste, in terms of usability, in terms of everything really, you know, time management. The simpler the better when it comes to food, in my opinion.
I have a question about the you and social media, because you seem to have taken it like a duck to water. It seems actually built for your kind of humour. It's these little short bits that just come out and just hit a subject in its funny bone. it's great fun watching your Twitter account.
Yeah, I love social media. I've been on Twitter for basically since it started, but social media is a fascinating tool for a writer, I would say. Instagram as well, for someone like me who writes cookbooks, I get to see every night, you know, 30 people around the world making my recipes for dinner, and I get to, and it's more interesting for me to see the comment there. It's like, this was fantastic and so easy, but then there might be one that's like, this tasted great, but it was a bit of an effort in the kitchen, you know, and it helps me to understand the audience more, which for a cookbook author is all important. You have to know what your audience is cooking and how they're cooking it, because I understand that not everyone in the world cooks the way that I do. I don't take particularly long in the kitchen either. I timed myself actually a couple of weeks ago every night for a week, and I cook on average for 18 minutes of an evening for dinner. So I'm not spending hours in the kitchen at all. But I understand that not everyone cooks the same way as me. You know, some people might want to take 5 minutes for dinner, or someone might take a dish that I'd take 18 minutes to cook, and it might take them 2.5 hours.
Yeah,
you know?
It takes me 20 minutes to make a sandwich.
So I really love social media, and Twitter's great for certain things. I love Twitter's news properties. I love its sense of humor properties. Instagram's great because I'm a bit of a hobby photographer as well, so I love Instagram and then Facebook as well.
Because I get the sense that there's a lot of freedom in your Twitter account. I mean, there are people who are selling stuff and they feel that they're confined. We, running a Booktopia corporate Twitter, we try to be as friendly
at Booktopia on Twitter, in case people.
but we know that there are places where we can't go. We can't sort of jump into the latest political debate or anything like that.
Yeah.
So, but you just sort of jump. You can jump anywhere. It's a lovely freedom.
It's nice. I think in social media, it's how thick your skin is, really. If I comment on something political on Twitter, or even sporting, which I tend to tweet about sport a lot as well, I will get abuse. That is par for the course on social media. If you've got a few followers and you want to have an opinion that's that you want to share with people, there are going to be people that disagree with you. So I don't mind the abuse, whether it's political or sporting related. But it's nice to have that freedom. I'm not trying to sell anyone anything through my accounts. I'm not trying to present a version of myself other than how I am. So I guess it just works.
Well, I think that wraps it up. I can't stress enough your last two books, because it's high standards, because I think your last two books have made the Booktopia Books of the Year for the illustrated beautiful big books. And this one, I'm not going to give anything away, but early days, it's a front runner already, because it's great. Adam Lau's Asian Cookery School, one of the best books of the year. Go out and grab it. Adam, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks, guys.
And John, thanks for delving a little bit deeper into the other man.
Adam the other man. It's a show coming. I'm going to be picked up by certain radio stations.
And remember, you can grab Adam Lau's Asian Cookery School from booktopia.com.au right now. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.